Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Everyone, welcome again to Mind Rolling. Raghu is here. I am back with Acharya Shunya, who is somebody that we've only met once, but welcome to the show, to the podcast.
Thank you, Raghu.
So, just to let you know, first of all, there's a Acharya put together a wonderful book, and and the thing that excites me most, or that I picked up when I got the book, was the reality of, well, first of all, India, which is so important to me. I've been going there regularly for a long, long, long time, many decades. And it is where I met my guru, Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba. So very, very, very fortunate. And so India is so full of many, many, many different teachings, many gods and goddesses. There is practically nobody that can say, wow, I didn't find something for me that turned me on in terms of the spiritual path. And one of the paths that is so very potentially profitable for people to enter into is, of course, Advaita or non-duality. But at the same time, what I really love here in terms of what you've done is set up a real opportunity for people to apply this ancient wisdom into practical day-to-day, which is all about what mind rolling is about. It's what I've been doing for years on podcasts, is getting with people and saying, okay, we have this knowledge. Now it's a matter of how to disseminate it in a way that is practical and people can apply it into where we are and where we're coming from now. And it's not just something to read about in a book. So that this book is full of all sorts of different, shall we say, wisdom practicalities is what I would call it. And but before we go there, we have to Acharya Shunya comes, everybody, from a very specific lineage, spiritual lineage from India. And this is something that you've been part of your entire life. And so we need to hear a little bit about from you, if you don't mind sharing just a little bit of your life story, right? And how you were in this family, what this family and tradition represents and your place in it. Can you? All the way back to when you were a child.
Raghu, we are from Ayodhya. And I believe you've been there.
Yes, I have.
So I grew up pretty close to the Hanuman temple, the Hanuman Gadi. We lived in a neighborhood not too far. And every morning I would visit the river Sarayu. Not every morning, but several mornings, where my grandfather, my Baba, my Guru would offer the Sandhya or the prayers to the rising sun. And as I was growing up, it felt like a very routine life at that time. I, my cousins, a few disciples of Baba, we would all go. And I and a couple of girls would play, and girls and boys would play and, you know, dive into the river. We were like fish. But gradually we were called into offering prayers, because when Baba, my guru, would go into meditative silence, we knew it's time to pray. And initially it was all just muttering and mumbling the Gayatri, but gradually that mantra descended into my being. I went through a fire ceremony at age 9. It was introduced into my ear traditionally, and ever since then we have been I have been studying. And then at a certain age, at age 24, I was told that I could now begin teaching. Although I didn't really take on my first spiritual student until age 40. Because in our tradition, even though you are ready, you have done what is known as, there are three steps of learning. You've done shravanam. So you've completed the listening of the Veda, Shravanam. But you are still doing Mananam, the contemplation. And the third stage of practice and teaching and dissemination follows thereafter, known as Nididhyasanam. And I had asked my guru, when will I know I'm ready? And he said, you will know without doubt. And ever since I started teaching, I never stopped, never questioned, never doubted whether I'm ready or not. And it felt like a coming off, coming into maturation with, or the ripening of that knowledge. And the book you're talking about, Sovereign Self, pretty much that has just flown from my being effortlessly. So I feel delighted that you visited my hometown. Most people are like, where? Ayodhya what? Because it's such a tiny town and it's not exactly Delhi, Agra, Calcutta kind of circuit, Mumbai, when people go to India.
But we should say what the reference is, what Ayodhya really, the powerful representation that it is, when from the Ramayana, when Ram was banished from his father's kingdom, and his wife and his brother Lakshman went to the forest in Chitrakoot, but was not the kingdom in Ayodhya?
Yes. That's Ram it. Was from Ayodhya.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Ram, for everybody, Ram is incarnation of Vishnu, as is Krishna. And in our tradition, that was extremely important, as Hanuman was everywhere. Wherever Neem Karoli Baba was, Hanuman was. So that's why we went and visited Ayodhya. That Hanuman has been, it's very ancient, is it not, that Murti?
Very ancient. It's very ancient. And in fact, this town itself, Ayodhya, is mentioned in the Rig Veda, the oldest text coming out of India. And in fact, the body itself is called Ayodhya, in which dwells Ram, the spirit. And I think for a tradition that is devoted to Hanumana, Ayodhya is a very important place, I would agree. And that temple, Hanumangadi, that you're talking about, it's one of the main landmarks of my city.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Do you know that we have, Ramdas and Siddhima and others put together a beautiful murti of Hanuman flying with the mountain? And it is in New Mexico, Taos, New Mexico now. And we just built an absolutely beautiful temple, or the trust put together, that was inaugurated. And Ramdas went literally 4 or 5 months before he passed. He made the, and he had not left Maui in a long, long, long time. And he went specifically for the installation of the murti in this beautiful temple in Taos. So if you ever get a chance,
please.
Yeah, do visit.
I watched the documentary on Netflix of Ram Dass's last days and his reflections and his stillness. His inner stillness was very obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there any time, though, you're growing up within this very prominent tradition, that you rebelled at all? I mean, we think of that in America. We rebelled about everything all the time, and we don't have the tradition that you have in India. What was that like for you? You wanted to go out, you know, I mean, you started to really get into a lot of studies, not to mention your regular school studies.
Yeah. So the studies were not too difficult in the sense that they were very early morning prior to my going to school, and then they would be satsang in the evening. But it became more and more intense, especially probably Baba, my guru, his name was Baba Yodhyanath. He had chosen me. So there was some focus upon me. And definitely around 13 or 14, I felt like we were the strangest family alive in India.
Why?
And India was changing. I was born in the 1960s. This was the mid-1970s, though Ayodhya itself, I don't know when you went there last, but even now we don't have a single movie theater there.
Yeah,
we don't have a mall, so it's still very simple. So it was not like in 1970s, everything around me was very modernized, urbanized. It was still a sleepy town, and we were an illustrious and important family. But I was also going to regular school, and I was reading, and I was learning. And so I would find a very traditional way of life back home. And I wondered when we would catch up, or, you know. And I particularly resisted what I had done all my life, which was waking up early. And for a while there, I didn't want to wake up early. And I write about it in another book of mine, Ayurveda Lifestyle Wisdom. And for a while there, I would wake up at like 7:30, which is very different from waking up at dawn. That was like late.
Yeah.
But the fun part was nobody scolded me and nobody shamed me. Everybody just went about their business. And after a while, it was just boring to stay in bed when like stuff was happening around you. So I went through my own rebellion. I went through my question marks. But I'll tell you something. It was the routines that I resisted more than the spiritual teachings. I remember being pretty young and listening about death and how death is like really just changing clothes. And so I would be like, I'd open my little mouth and listen to Baba when he would teach, or when he would be teaching his students, I would be in the back when I was not his regular student. And I would just be sitting with my head on my mother's lap listening, and I would be curious, and I would listen to some words and ask him the meaning of it afterwards. So we say in India that your propensity or your prakriti or your sahaja nature, your inherent propensities come out. And as Lord Krishna has said in the Gita, that if we are, some of us, if we are yoga bhrashtas, we have fallen off our path in some lifetime. We were sincere, we either fell off or we met death prematurely or something. The Lord is kind to us, and we might find ourselves born in the teacher's family or near the teacher's family. Mm. Somehow we'll find our way quickly rather than late. And so I feel like I was completing some unfinished business when I would, I didn't talk like this earlier, but now in my 50s, in hindsight, now I realize why I actually enjoyed learning ancient Shankaracharya commentaries when some friends of mine were watching black and white television, all of them collected together to watch one television set in India in some house while I would be sitting with my grandfather. And I didn't know always how to connect the worlds, and I was awkward with it. We're also a householder tradition. So we take on a marriage partner, we have children, we go through life, and we go through ashramavastha, we go through stages of life, we complete our dharmas, and yet we try to find the four goals of life, artha, dharma, kama, moksha, you know, that whole spectrum of going from survival, pleasure, dharma, and liberation, but within the scope of family life. So it's been an interesting journey all in all, and rebellion is one way to describe it.
But then, so part of this family, as you said, they were householder families. Interesting, because that's our tradition as well. Everybody is devotees of Neem Karoli Baba. They were all family people. Sadhus did come, but he didn't take any disciples or anything. That was not part of the tradition. So I understand it quite well. And but then at some point, your parents arranged your marriage. Yep. Must be.
Yes. That's just how it goes in our traditional families. And I was all gung-ho of making it the marriage of my lifetime. And this is where 20th century meets tradition.
Oh.
And I found that despite all the parameters being checked, this was not a comfortable equation for me.
And it was done through astrology, right? Vedic astrology?
Some of that, I'm not exactly sure what were the procedures followed, because that was not what we girls did, like ask why this person was chosen.
Yeah.
But, and a very respectable and a very good family. But then, see, this is where I'm a different teacher for the 21st century. This is where I changed the tradition. This is where I had to look into the Vedas and see not only what the male seers were saying, but what were the female seers who have also written the Vedas saying, where I found that, where I had to reinterpret the goddess mythology also. And I had to say that, oh, Durga is the first, woman who has broken all stereotypes. And Lakshmi was not just one domesticated goddess. You know, she is an out-of-the-box goddess.
A what goddess? And
Lakshmi too is an out-of-the-box goddess. She's not just a domesticated goddess. So, we see so many forms of Lakshmi. So then I, you know, took on a new, I exited that marriage using all my Vedic knowledge with Dharma, with peace, with harmony, speaking my truth. And that's where it took me time to bring this truth into my life, Raghu. Because if I followed the script, then I should just stay in the marriage and hold a satsang where I would just be allowed to have a satsang in India just because I come from this bad family. But instead, I was like, can I really have a satsang when I'm not experiencing the satsang or association with the highest truth within me? And that is where I had a whole decade from my 30s, or rather almost a decade and a half of going through life, churning it, coming to clarity, and then realizing that my tradition is asking me to lead the boldest version of my life possible from inner peace, from Dharma, and from authenticity. And that the Vedas or the non-dual wisdom doesn't just teach oneness, oneness, oneness. It teaches through the battle of Kurukshetra in the Mahabharata, looking at an asuric or an evil being and saying that's not acceptable. Where I found that every teaching possible, from saying no to toxic relationships, to creating the life that you were meant to lead, to living the life that you were meant to lead, to finding your purpose, and to being the boldest goddess version of yourself, is exactly the teachings. And I, when I go back to my own family, I did not receive dogma there. I just received pure teaching. But then my life situations happened where I had to even go beyond the pure teachings into reinterpreting them for the 21st century. And that is when I came into my own as a teacher, because I don't know, Raghu, but as a person, I'm not just able to repeat something. I'm not a memorizing teacher. Yes, I know a couple of several hundred shlokas and verses and hymns and stotrams. And, you know, and I can sing from morning to night and wow the audience, but that's not my interest, to just repeat the text. My interest in saying, how does the story of Ramayana, Mahabharata, the Puranas, the stories of the goddesses, the legends of Saraswati, Durga, Kali, how do I use them in my life today? While being a guru to thousands worldwide. And I guess these are the teachings then that came out in Sovereign Self, which are making them so, which is making this book so appealable to people worldwide.
Absolutely.
And I've dared to do something different, but if you were to read every line of it, it's still tethered in Dharma. Tethered in Dharma, because Dharma accommodates not good or bad, but right action. And sometimes that right action with me, as Hanumana did, he went in peace to Lanka. But when they didn't listen to him, he set his own, when they set his tail on fire, he reduced Lanka to ashes. But he had gone as a peace ambassador. So our gods have been teaching us right action, not to be just too holy for ourselves, or, you know, what is it called?
Self-serious is a You know, I must say to everybody, because you said how this marriage, you exited the marriage that was arranged for you. And so all the listeners, this has no effect whatsoever to them in any way, because in the West... And you live here as well, so you really have your foot in both traditions. But here, people exit marriages on a regular basis. This is not news to anybody. You say that, oh, yeah, okay. But in India, and maybe not everybody knows this, this is something that is extraordinary. I had For instance, I had a mentor who was very close to Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji, named K.C. Tiwari, and he was wide open. He was the headmaster of a boarding school up in the Himalayas, and yet he was an incredible, accomplished yogi, devotee of Mother and Shiva. And he used to say, I am wide open to everything, but you people in the West, the way that you easily just get divorced and so on, this even for me is difficult to chew on. So I can't imagine the what this happening was like for you when you made that decision and your family knew about it. So this was a big deal. I can only imagine, right?
Thank you for contextualizing it because. Then it became a landmark moment for me to choose my truth and also the pretentiousness around holiness. Mm. Like if you're holy, you got it together, including your marriage, including your sexuality, including your angst, you just put a lid on it. And I've met so many householder couples who are into the holy business, but their life is not at all holy. I, on the other hand, chose to choose my wholeness over holiness. And I did this while I was in India. So it's not like I came to America, learned of some new ideas, borrowed some power from the Westerners, and then decided to do what I wanted to do. So by the time I took on a new partner, who, by the way, teaches alongside me because he's an Ayurveda chef, along with doing his other stuff in the world. He also teaches cuisine, and we have our own life, and we were meant to do the work together. And so from that perspective, and I want to come back to the non-duality. When I look at the partner I left behind, and from a non-dual perspective, if we both share different bodies, minds, opinions, but share the same self, then I even bow to the person I left behind. It's not like somebody hurt me or I feel like this is a play and I'm playing a role and different parts of me are coming as the ex or the present or the student, coming and going, and life is just happening. And that sense of unity consciousness allows me a sense of shantam bhava, inner peace, that all is well, and I'm just meeting me in different body suits of different shades of darkness and light. And I'm using them to find me, and my books reflect that, I guess.
Mm. Yeah. Hey, since we're on this relationship subject, and I know towards the end of the book, Atma Shakti, bringing soul power to relationships, here's your just a little quote I'll read from the Mahabharata. Never do that to another which you regard as injurious to your own self. This, in brief, is the rule of dharma. Yielding to impulse and acting from ego, one becomes guilty of a dharma. So very straightforward. And you tell that story of the snake. I love that story because it says so much. You remember?
Yes, I do.
Tell it.
Don't remember the chapter number, but we were talking about, ahimsa as a dharma. And
non-killing.
Yeah, non-violence and non-killing, non-hurting. And it's a really great dharma, but sometimes we have to understand the subtleties of the context in which it should be employed. So there was a snake, and he lived near a tree, and he had quite a reputation. You know, he would just bite at all the children who would play around the tree and anybody he could find. He was a bit sensitive, and he was a biter. And his bite was, of course, poisonous. It was a bit of a nuisance. But as it happens in India, people like my Baba go from village to village and give satsangs or sermons. And so some Sadhu Baba had come, some Rishi, some sage-like person. And he gave a sermon on Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. Ahimsa is the greatest dharma, on nonviolence. And he spoke so beautifully that the snake, whose soul was really getting ready to evolve, was like, gosh, that's so amazing. And he said, look at me, I'm hurting everybody, even those little kids who come playing. So he decided he will stop biting. Couple of months passed and monsoon passed, and then the Sadhu Baba came again, because they go round and round in different villages. And this time he saw the snake, and the snake looked really battered, and, you know, as if something had worn him out. He looked weak, he looked half dead. And so the sadhu said, what happened to you? What happened? Last time I met you, you looked so gorgeous. Your skin was shining, your hood was up. And the snake said, well, I heard your sermon last time, and so I just quit biting others. And so the Baba looked at him and said, okay, so I probably suggested stop biting, but why did you stop hissing? And this was a teaching on having boundaries. And you don't want to become so... you don't want to become nonviolent in such an indiscriminate fashion that you become a pushover and you become the victim of other people's lack of dharma. So dharma includes self-protection. Dharma includes using judicious violence, even if necessary, such as you might need to use police force or army or whatever. The surgeon needs to use a knife to do some good. And so this kind of balanced teaching is the hallmark of the Vedas or the deeper Hindu teachings, where they don't just say one thing is always right. In fact, they even say, like, compassion, the best possible dharma, but watch it. If you have compassion for toxic people, not a good idea. That is called moha, wrong thing to do.
Yeah, moha. This just reminds me of when you just said this. There was a Tibetan teacher named Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche that we knew back in the day. He was also a fabulous interpreter of Buddhist concepts, Tibetan Buddhist concepts, into practicality. He's one of those people. And he wrote a whole thing around the concept of idiot compassion, he used to call it, right? Which, moha compassion, same thing, you know. Yes. And we tend to do that. We are at times ill-suited to do right action, because our view is clouded, just completely obscuration. But in terms of applying this particular story and this concept, apply it to a relation. I mean, because everybody, I mean, this isn't just relations of a couple, relations between parents and children, siblings, people you work with, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it applies across the board, and you have this, a happy ending is not always possible, but dharma is always possible. Maybe explicate that just a little bit.
When we're looking for happy endings, we are often compromising to have that happy ending. Mm. And that happy ending could be based on a fantasy, on conditioning, on some script that we are running. For example, if my happy ending was that once you get married in an arranged marriage, you stay married forever, you know, come rain, come hail, come sunshine, you know, and that's happy ending. But for me, dharma was standing up against patriarchy, standing up against being boxed into roles where my freedom to be who I am was being questioned. And So dharma, in my, for example, situation was walking out that door, no matter what the consequence. And countless students of mine, it's not just in India. I came to America and I now have 9 out of 10 of my students are not Indians.
Yeah.
And I meet men and women who are ready for sentimental reasons, and the idiot's compassion is flowing through them for the wrong person, for the wrong reason, out of sheer habit or conditioning or guilt. We are often making decisions based on our gut feeling, but when dharma comes into the picture, we don't just want to earn, we don't just want to be good at any cost.
Mm.
We may even be bad, but we know that dharma is with us, ethics is with us, morality is with us, truth is with us. And in that moment, it may appear like we are acting in a manner that is not appreciated by society or the other or our friends, but your inner conscience knows you're right, especially if you're aligned on the right side of the dharma. So sometimes, for example, if I have to talk to a student and show them the mirror, I could be a popular teacher and just say, how lovely, how wonderful, I bless you. Because that's what they expect of their teacher. Instead, I say to them, what are you doing? Am I just a fantasy in your life? Is this spiritual work? Why are you here? What are you avoiding in your life? Do you actually need to go shopping instead of studying Bhagavad Gita? If that's your truth, do that. Rather than, you know, how we bypass and pretend to our own selves that we are ready for salvation or liberation or self-actualization when actually we have big holes in our being that we could not fill. So when such a person comes and I tell them the truth or I show them that they are not ready, it makes me unpopular in the moment. But if I was that person, would I speak truth to myself? I would. So dharma is always possible. A happy ending or a happy note is not always possible. Of course, with ahimsa guiding us, we can make our speech pleasant, non-hurtful, but still we must deliver the truth.
Mm, and that truth difficult. Is
the truth is a carrier of dharma. Mm,
yeah. Very difficult. One must, I think you'll agree, know oneself very well to be able to connect with the truth and see the motivations that we have of self-interest that are so powerful. Desire, clinging, all of it. So.
And the study of the Vedic text, what we call Shastra, helps because it teaches dharma. The dharma of arjavam or straightforwardness, the dharma of amanitvam or non-pretentiousness, the dharma of non-violence, ahimsa, the dharma of kshanti, accommodation of others, the dharma of shanti, peacefulness. So once when we study these teachings over years and years, and so I studied about this dharma called straightforwardness, like an arrow.
I was just going to go back to you and say, talk about that. That is
talk
something I
that.
Have never heard about. What's the Hindi for it or Sanskrit?
Right. Arjavam is Sanskrit for straight, to be straight like an arrow. And it asks us, this is from the Bhagavad Gita, and it asks us that whenever we speak, we should pause. And we should make sure our speech is aligned with what we are thinking, so there's no deception. But then it says, and I love this, it says, make sure what you're thinking is aligned with what you're feeling.
Mm.
So this is like the ultimate for emotional health and preventing self-deception and, misaligning with our own being. Mm. And when you become straight like an arrow, then you speak your truth. And somehow Indian spirituality became all about ahimsa and daya, kindness. But some of these direct ones, like, hey, are you straightforward or not? These ones didn't get talked about as much. And I like to bring them up because as a householder, I feel like we also need these Dharma values to guide us. And so sometimes, for example, if I find it's difficult to bring up a topic, you know, this Arjavama, this arrow-like Dharma keeps hurting me till I can align it up and utter it. Then I feel better, Raghu. And that's why in my book, Sovereign Self, I have a whole chapter on 20 Dharma values that I have picked up from different spiritual texts for a householder. So that we can, besides the Yama Niyamas of Patanjali or, you know, can we also have some more Yamas and Niyamas that help ordinary folks?
Yeah, right. There, in this chapter around relationships and so on, there's a word that you use that I have found it very difficult. I was another mentor of ours named K.K. Shah, actually. He used to come to the retreats from India. He was very, Ram Dass is like Indian brother. It's the first translator with Neem Karoli Baba and so on. And one of the concepts that he would constantly talk about, but it was very difficult to for people to understand it, is maryada. And he would, the example he used from the Ramayana was, I mean, I remember one story where Ram is with his brother Lakshman and they're going to save Sita with the army and they're going to Sri Lanka. And one of the rascal, shall we say, deities maybe in the ocean, I can't remember which one, wouldn't comply with Ram's request to help get over to Sri Lanka. And Lakshman, his brother, looked at him and went, "What? Oh, you just kill him. You can do anything. Turn him into a snail, whatever. You're God incarnate. You can do." And Ram said, no, this is not proper conduct. That is the way I have understood maryada. So I'd love for you to give an interpretation around that, because it's a very powerful term, and especially in this particular tradition, in the Ramayana. I mean, in India,
yes.
No matter what.
Yes, and interestingly, in the Sovereign Self, I have spoken about maryada. It is such a core context of behavior.
Yeah.
And if I would say that if there is something lacking in the 21st century, the irreverence that we see worldwide, it comes
cynicism.
From a loss of maryada, yeah, the mockery, the cynicism. And so maryada is what the way my teacher had explained it was like how the river, when it is flowing within its own channel, she is called a goddess, she is Devi. But when that river grows outside her channel, then she becomes a killer because now she has become a flood. She has become, Nivritti or Kali. She has become, she's out to punish you. So just like that, when we all have channels through which we flow, through which the cosmos wants us to flow, there is the concept of what is being asked of you, Swadharma. What is your duty? What is your responsibility? What are those indulges or luxuries that you can get away with? And what is it that you cannot neglect? Like a mother who is tending to an infant, her maryada is that she can do anything, but she cannot neglect that infant. Or I'm a spiritual teacher. I'm also a mother, a sister, a daughter, a daughter-in-law. But I'm prima facie, I'm a spiritual teacher. I'm a guru. whether I'm alone or whether I'm in the public, I cannot forget this maryada that I am a teacher and people look up to me. I am their role model. When that maryada is remembered by me, I will, even when I'm alone, know my limits, know my do's and don'ts, know what is possible and what is not possible. Lord Rama is known as Maryada Purushottamama,
yeah,
because he was the ultimate teacher of Maryada, because though he was the supreme reality, he had come in the contained Maryada of being a human being, albeit a prince, but the one who was not even in charge of his own kingdom. He had been banished for whatever reasons to a forest, for unfair reasons or whatever. It was his Leela. But so he knew what were his tools. So he didn't, like, for example, run to Ayodhya to get his dad's army to save his wife from Lanka. He didn't use any of the resources that had been taken away from him. So even in his princely role, he knew his maryada. Then he knew his maryada that he was not going to suddenly flout cosmic laws and cosmic do's and don'ts. He stayed within his human limits and was an ideal of what action to take. I have grown up with Rama's myth. You know, growing up in Ayodhya, our deity is Rama, Sita, Lakshmana, Hanumana, because we have grown up in Ram Lala's home in Ayodhya. So for us, every night when Baba would give satsang on all of these divine beings from the Ramayana, what we really learned was Maryada. I mean, Hanuman is Lord Shiva himself. But when Hanumana comes in the form of that bhakti mode and sits there and says, you know, I am your servant, and he says that to, when he says, I am your servant to Lord Rama, it's like he's equal or he's the same, because Vishnu and Shiva are one in the non-dual teaching. But they're all in their maryadas. Sita is Shakti. She's not afraid of Ravana. In fact, one blade of grass that she held and Ravana couldn't come close. But she remained in the maryada of being the wife. That doesn't mean, maryada doesn't mean be less, but maryada means be cognizant that we are all playing roles, cosmic roles. We also have cosmic duties. We also have cosmic gifts that we have to unpack within us. But it should all be done within maryada. And today, everybody is usurping each other's maryada.
And, how so?
And that's the world we live in nowadays. Yeah.
An example of that is usurping each other's maryada.
Absolutely. For example, I know that students, for example, somebody like me has studied formally for 14 years, informally for 40, formally for 14 years, and informally, like on my own, swadhyaya, self-study, for 40 years. But there will be students who will do a short course and declare themselves spiritual teachers. It's a common example. Mm-hmm. There will be people who have walked through the political circle. They have served at a city level, county level, state level. They have built their way through service, through policy making, through being involved. And then there are some just on their popularity ticket or their money or their clout, suddenly want to leap across and become our leaders. I don't want to take names. So the point here is that this is no longer the rule of Dharma. That's why in Rama Rajya, or when there is the rule of Dharma and everybody's in their maryada, it is known as the kingdom of Rama. But we are not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And now
Satyuga. No.
Satyuga. People play all kinds of roles. They pretend. If you do, if fake it until you make it, doggy dog world. Everybody, you know how to get. You know, it's whatever you can grab and clutch and hide and hoard. Mm. That's yours to claim and pretend and a feather in your cap. So the old, but these are not old values. Maryada still supports you. For example, I've been in this country now for 20 years. And I have an organization that is free of scandal, pure, clean. And I go, yeah, where is that coming from? Not luck, not good luck, from the cognizance that you better stay in your Maryada Shunya, then the next person will stay in their Maryada, then the next person will stay in their Maryada. It's when the spiritual teachers themselves are spilling everywhere that there is all kinds of leaky energy. And then what we have is a loss of Maryada, and concurrent with that is the loss of Dharma.
Yeah. Well, you just explained out mostly what's going on for the in the West or in America in particular. Very difficult times all around. Let me read something from the book that I love. And everybody out there, you know, if you're talking about, gee, what are the how to make this really practical for me, let's identify something first, which Shunya beautifully identifies in the book. This is just, there's so much, unfortunately, that we are dealing with. And here, in here, you are talking about egoic personal persona, acting out, lying, stealing, cheating, manipulating, all of the things. And we often lie to ensure our essential security. We break others down by gossiping to feel a sense of our own internal perfection. We overeat to feel the satisfaction of our inner fullness. We cheat and manipulate to grab power from others, to experience our own, quote-unquote, not quote, in parentheses, inherent spiritual power. We cheat and betray within our sexual relationships to feel greater moments of inner joy. We kill others to not only get someone out of the way of our own happiness, but to experience a sense of our own power or sense of immortality. In this way, even our wrongdoing points to the truth of who we really are. The first role of the ego is to associate with experiences and spin a quote-unquote I and quote-unquote mine narrative. Its second role, however, is to act as the portal to infinite happiness and knowledge. This must be accomplished by effort, reflection, and discrimination, aided by wisdom of the Vedas. Our journey of awakening to ourself depends on how we reconcile our ego with ourself and bringing the ego into greater alignment through sacred instruction. That kind of is the core of what we are all going through, right? And basically what this whole book is centered around is exactly that. And how do we bring this together? The ego is a terrible master but a great servant if your perspective switches over. And yeah, just talk about that for a minute, because I think that's really the core of what we're dealing with. And some of these... metaphors you talk about right here, everybody can go, whoops, yep, manipulation, yep, you know, lying, right? Overeating, I mean, everything we do to move into our comfort zone, which we have had as a habitual pattern our entire life and have not dealt with and are happily, especially if you're on the spiritual path, happy to do a little bit of bypassing in order to stave off dealing with going through the transformation necessary So ego is no longer the Lord and Master and is the servant.
Well, you know, I wrote these lines because there's a basic premise of the Vedas, which makes me a fan of the Vedas. I love how kind they are when they observe. And when I say the Vedas, I mean the entire gamut, Bhagavad Gita, Ramayana, Puranas, Upanishads. All of them have this basic observation to make that nobody is evil. Nobody is evil. They're only a little bit lost. Ignorance. They have avidya. They have ignorance because if they knew better, they wouldn't be that. Now, this was just something I'd heard repeated again and again and again, that it is avidya or maya, which, you know, confuses us. And we start building little islands of the ego and me and mine. And we get lost in these tiny little battles and we forget that we're all one. And this is like a core teaching of the Upanishads. But then when I brought it into my life, when I started working with people, I started counseling them as a teacher. I'm not a trained counselor, but any spiritual teacher often counsels lost souls. I found that I was standing across people who had in their own minds done great crime. They had hurt people, or they had hurt themselves, or I remember meeting this one person who had even peddled drugs and become really rich in San Francisco because of that. But now they had pangs of guilt and self-hatred. And in every case, I found that ultimately it was an awkward and stupid attempt of the ego to return to its own bigness. But it was trying to do it in a very material and, if I may say so, ultimately not a very smart way. Like, for example, like when the ego tries to make a point. Well, we often do that, but often the one who's already aware of their power need not make a point. They'll just live that point. So when I wrote these words, I was talking about how in silly little ways, because the ego has forgotten that it is not a poor little orphan, and it belongs to the self, which is one with God. It has forgotten that it already has all the thunder and power and grace of Divine Mother and Divine Father with it. It is not this thing that settles for crumbs or seduces and manipulates and begs and puts on a farce and an act to get little crumbs. And so when I analyzed the awkward, misaligned, non-adaptive behaviors, ultimately from the eyes of knowledge and compassion, you realize it was nothing but we humans trying to touch something eternal within us. But instead, we come away with acidity and burping. We don't really touch Atma, the self. We touch something very ugly. And then we think that's it. That's who we are. And then we try to like cover it up and go into some hypocritical space, which causes psychosomatic illness. Or we live with it and we hate ourselves. And neither position is needed. Neither we need to ignore it and pretend something else, nor we need to hate ourselves. We need to say, oh, it's just my ego. It needs education. It needs to come back in proximity with self and God, which is really one in the non-dual tradition. And so if you catch God, you'll come close to self. If you catch self, you'll come close to God. So it's either way, that divine reality. Ego is only a little imagined separation. And in that imagination, we have come away very far and we are suffering and we're hating ourselves and loathing ourselves, or we are hurting others. But if we relax all of this, then we can have radical self-acceptance. And you're very right. This is the core of the spiritual journey, is our egos has a twin role to play. First, it plays a role of making us lost in the existential fog called Maya. And we try to catch our own tail and we never do. Through money, through sex, through achievements, through fame, through name. And then the second part of the role is when we question, why am I trying to catch the tail? And in a content space, we realize that we are complete and we don't have to do any such maneuvers. And life becomes simple, sacred, whole, and sovereign, in my words, where you're not doing things compulsively. Sovereign has, you have authority over what you're doing. You know why you're doing it. You have a say in it. You, the soul, has a say in it. So the journey of the sovereign from bondage to sovereignty is not from goodness, badness to goodness, evil to holiness, but it's from compulsiveness and conditioned behavior and awkward, self-destructive, self-sabotaging behavior to strategic, intelligent, aware living, really.
I wanted to say we are getting too close to the end of the podcast. And but I couldn't leave without bringing up this one, and it's in one of the chapters, and it's around guru, recognizing a true teacher is the name of the chapter, and it's also when you talk, many people have a perception. That's what I was trying to say, of Advaita non-dual teachings as cold, distant, not at all connected to the opening up of the deepest part of ourselves. Many teachers do teach that way, unbeknownst, I think. And I think that's can be a problem with non-dual teachers. That's so prevalent here in the West, and particularly in America. Those are the books that sell, okay? Not books with bhakti. They don't sell because it's much easier for especially Westerners to go through mind. And in this case, though, the way that you in particular, for instance, talk about your guru, your Baba, the way that you're connected with just talking about the Ramayana and Ram, this is full of bhakti to me. That's what I'm getting. And so here's your shloka from the Katha Upanishad. The truth of self cannot come through one who has not realized that he or she is the self. Pure Advaita, right? Awakening comes not through logic and scholarship, but from close association with an awakened master. And I've said many, many, many times because, you know, well, you were lucky you got over to India and met this realized being, but we can't. We can't even think of it. Or are these beings still around? You know, all of those kind of questions. And I would say two things. One is a true master who has gone beyond duality and lived in a human body, a siddha is what they call them in India, is not bound by a body. So that's one thing. This has nothing to do with a body. That's one thing. And the other thing I tell people is, yes, everybody has that guide, the deepest part of themselves. It manifests in many different ways. It can manifest in the physical, as it happened with Ram Dass and us. It can manifest in a billion other ways. But what happens, in my experience, is a certain kind of connection to intuition, to the truth, happens. And as you become more comfortable with that space, that which is unnameable connects with one. And every one of us has that possibility. And I think that's super important, especially for people in the West, to understand and relax a little bit. We are being taken care of. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. Lord Krishna has said in the Bhagavad Gita, just yearn for the truth and I shall supply you a teacher and a book and whatever you need. It shall happen in some way. And the true guru is not located in a geophysical plane, in a specific body. The guru tattva, that guru, that wisdom of the cosmos shall come to you. It shall it will be your miracle. And that guru may not have a guru profession, a guru website, a guru anything. When Ramdas found Neem Karoli Baba, no other Westerner knew about him. So it's like you will find your teacher and your teachings. And sometimes a current lifetime is a preparatory lifetime. Sometimes it is a concluding lifetime. But preparatory always has to precede concluding. So just the quality of your yearning is what is needed. And in my chapter, I've just given some red flags. Like, don't just follow the guru with the maximum bodies following them. Don't just follow trends. Intuition plays a big role, and there'll be an inner voice that guides you and tells you, I'm safe here. And do look for antecedents and precedents around the guru. Don't ignore some big question marks. Bring them up. And I had to write this chapter on the request of my publisher. And not that I had to. I had almost written it, but they wanted to include it because in the 21st century, the word guru is either a bad word or a joke word or a mocking word or a no word. You know, it doesn't have the gravitas with which I and you use it. That's why I wanted to return the gravitas and say, There might be 10 unfortunate people pretending to be gurus, but if you're sincere, one sincere teacher is going to be matched by you, for you. This universe is so intelligent. Every atom is in its right place. And just like you found people who took you on the wrong path, when you are ready, the path sure shall just emerge. In today's world, you may listen to a podcast, you may come to a Facebook page, you may turn a page, a book may drop from a shelf in a library, and the guru tattva, that big guru abstract principle, is knocking you on the head. That's what I would say.
Yep. No, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Shunya, for being here. By the way, we haven't even said, what does your name mean? I know what it means, but you please do say it because it's very powerful.
My name means the divine void, the divine emptiness. And I just have a small story that it also means zero because
zero is what I was going to say, yeah.
And when I was growing up, children would tease me, zero, zero. And I thought, Baba has everything right but my name. But as I grew older, I realized that he wants me to touch that shunya space, that divine emptiness in which everything can be born and returned to. Mm.
Very good name.
Thank you. Now I know that.
Yeah. So again, thank you for being here. We have
always a pleasure.
We would have to do, I don't know, another 10 podcasts to cover. So, and I have notes here of all. Well, we'll do it again.
I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Okay. We'll definitely do it again. And by the way, in the show notes, we'll get you links to Shunya's website and the book, Sovereign Self, and maybe a link to what was the first sacred Indian text that we came into contact with. Obviously, we did know of, when we were kids, of the Bhagavad Gita, but not really of the Ramayana, and that became the central sacred text for us. And Maharaji used to say, just read Sundar Kand every Tuesday. which it translates as the beautiful, which is the story of Ram's wife being kidnapped and him finding her again through the grace of Hanuman. So, and we have to talk about this. So many different levels of that. We could go, just one podcast just on that would be great.
Just
so we have
on
to
that.
Do.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 So again, thank you. Thank you. It was a delight. It took a little while because Acharya has been in India and just came back a couple of months ago. And we didn't talk about that. I wanted to hear all about that too. So, yeah.
Let's get a list going of our podcast.
Yeah, right. Really, really. Thank you. And everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and just reap the rewards of many, many, many great teachers from Ram Dass to Jack Kornfield to Joseph Goldstein and on and on. And we have even we have Alan Watts now on our network. Who we love, who Ram Dass was close to. So we shall see you next week. Namaste. Namaste.